don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Good morning, welcome to Second Captain Saturday. And let me just say right off the bat, I don't see any reason why you would enjoy the show today. I'm sorry. I meant to say I don't see any reason why you wouldn't enjoy the
excellent.
Show today.
Excellent.
It's sort of really a double. It's sort of a double negative. So you can put that in. I think that probably clarifies things pretty good by itself. Hi, Murph. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you?
Hey, old.
I had to do it, Murph. I'm sorry.
No, it was good.
You're very welcome back from Moscow, I should say.
Oh, thank you, Owen. Good to see you.
I'm not sure if the wouldn't defense is going to get the American president out of his latest scandal. The New York Times reporting last night that his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, secretly recorded a conversation with Trump 2 months before the election in which they discussed payments to a former Playboy model who said she had an affair with Trump. These are payments that he has previously denied any knowledge of. Now, this isn't to be confused with the Stormy Daniels case. This is another alleged payment to a woman called Karen McDougal. It's been a rough old week. I thought
those guys were good friends. I can't believe that they were secretly taping each other's conversations about delicate matters such as that.
What did you make of his performance against your new best pal, Vladimir?
Well, it was an interesting thing to watch last week. There's a piece on the front of the Irish Times Weekend Review here by Fintan O'Toole, which he recently did a piece about trial runs for fascism, which became, I think, became the most read piece ever on the Irish Times website.
It was excellent and extremely scary, Ken.
But he sort of returned to this area with the piece about the Helsinki summit. It says, if Europe is not to follow the US, it will have to wake up to the political epidemic that Putin has started. And I think if I have a problem with this piece, it's actually that headline. I don't agree that this is something which has been started, but this isn't just because I've been in Russia for the last few weeks.
Here we go. Putin's useful idiot strikes again.
Yeah,
but it's not. It's kind
whatever
of
he's
like,
paying you, kid.
There's this sort of notion that this is like, I always feel it's a slightly dangerous road to go down when you say, well, you know, the piece is sort of talking about the behavior of Trump. Putin seems to be controlling him. What's going on? But the notion that he could have been elected because of something that was cooked up in Russia seems a little bit far-fetched. I mean, I remember during that campaign, Obama, who when he sort of thought, oh, I'd better get out there and start making some speeches here for Hillary Clinton, gave one speech where he talked about the Republican Party saying they've been feeding their base all kinds of crazy for years and started listing off a bunch of things. And I could, you know, when you remember that, was it always Russia who was giving them the talking points, who was teaching them that, you know, taxation is theft and that, you know, socialized medicine is communism and, you know, everybody must worship the military. You know, was this a Russian idea? I mean, there's a paragraph in Fintan's piece where he says, the conditions that make Russia so miserable, elections that can't be trusted, news that is composed of alternative facts, ruled by a self-aggrandizing oligarchy, media that are either compliant or excoriated as enemies of the people, a politics of toxic self-pity, are being successfully injected into the West. Clearly, you could say those things about the United States and the United Kingdom, which I imagine is why Fintan has written it that way. But are we really saying that this is because the Russians have kind of managed to, you know, inject this into the conversation? I mean, there's a piece on the next page of this Weekend Review by David McWilliams, where he talks about a speech that Margaret Thatcher gave in 1988 in Bruges, in which she kind of laid out the Eurosceptic view. You know, oh, we've had enough of this integration in Europe. And he kind of talks about how that sort of laid the ground for what we have now, Brexit, you know, 30 years later. Now, say what you like about Margaret Thatcher. I don't think that she was saying what the Russians were telling her to say. We're talking about a different Russia in 1988, but what I'm saying is that I think they managed to cook this up without much help from the Russians. I think the Russians were fanning flames that were already there.
Our guest today is one of the very best comedians and actors in the business. You'll know her from some of the biggest shows out there, like 8 out of 10, Cats, Live at the Apollo and The Fall. Aisling B is on the way. You may well have read Aisling's beautiful piece about her late father that she wrote in The Guardian and The Irish Times last year, which touched a huge number of people. She's also part of a new Netflix comedy special and has written and will star in a new series for Channel 4. So we can't wait to have Aisling B on the show this morning. And she will have, Murph, Aisling will have her one and only chance to compete for the second captain's greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson title this very morning. Please remind us of the not very intimidating standards being set so far.
could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Yes, last week's guest Paul Howard scored a header with a pair of glasses on in an under 11 match, which earned him glory at the time, as well as twisted glasses, but alas, only earned him 72 points last week. This season's second captain Saturday greatest non-sportsperson leader remains David Baddiel, who scored 75 points. Kildare's Ashlingby comes from a family rich in sporting tradition, we're told. So we're expecting big things this morning on.
51551 is a number to text. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at Second Captains. Ashlingby is coming right up. This is Second Captain Saturday. Going an awful long way to find a better tune than that one to get you going on a Saturday morning. Let's be honest, Teenage Kicks by the Undertones there. Ashling B has arrived. Ashling, you're very welcome to Second Captain Saturday.
Hello, gentlemen of sport. How are you all?
We're good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people know you as a comedian.
But not as a sports superstar.
This is what this next half an hour is all about.
Me finally launching my sporting career.
Horses is your background.
Horses is my background.
That's not really a question.
Sounded like an accusation. Yes, so I grew up in just outside of Kildare town to an equine vet of a father. That's not, again, a slander. That's genuinely a job. And my mother is a retired professional flat race jockey.
Right. So tell us about your mother's career then, as best you know. How did she end up becoming a flat race jockey?
She comes from a very horsey background. My grandfather, Con Maloney, and kind of agricultural background, he actually was one of the founders of Machrana Ferma, of the Irish Farmers Association. If there's any English people listening in who don't understand our national tongue. And so they grew up with lots of animals around the house all the time. And my granny was also a big horse rider. She was an amazing woman, and so all of like my aunties and that all rode growing up, and my mother was the one who I think was the most passionate about it, to take it to a professional level. She, interestingly enough, she worked at RACE, which is the Racing Apprentice Centre of Education, where they train young jockeys in Kildare, for about 30 years as a teacher. But when she wanted to go and train there as a jockey, they wouldn't let any girls in.
Right.
And because of her talent, she was set up in Con Collins's yard, and they kind of spotted her as being really good. And then she went on from becoming apprentice to a professional. But when she went back to teach, she could teach in the place. But at that point, there was no girls allowed.
Right. So initially, it was simply, this doesn't exist. There aren't girl jockeys. So there was nobody for her to follow.
Yeah, she was quite a pioneer for female jockeys. Herself and Joanna Morgan were kind of coming up around the same time. Joanna's still a trainer now. And my mother has worked in horse racing all her life. Like, it's weird because it's kind of like, imagine if you were brought up in a town full of magicians and both of your parents were magicians, and everyone in that you knew, and the town's industry was fueled by magicians. And suddenly you went to Dublin one day and people were like, magicians. You're like, I know, it's so boring. Because in Kildare, like, loads of people's parents were either jockeys or in the army or worked for farriers or had something to do with even horses in the army. And so it just felt really normal that everyone had something to do with the horse racing industry in Kildare. My summer job was working on the stud farm on the Irish National Stud as a tour guide. So it just felt really, and even still, people are like, oh, you should write more stand-up about that. I'm like, but what angle? Isn't everybody's mother a jockey? But I'm extremely proud of her, because it is interesting how much it kind of, there aren't, there's lots more now, but there aren't as many women in my industry in comedy as there should and could and hopefully will be. But it is interesting growing up watching a woman in a male-dominated industry and kind of like ploughing ahead. So her work as a jockey is very similar to, there are lots of parallels in terms of her career with mine. I remember she always said that, like, if she won a race, it was because the horse was fast. But if she lost a race, oh, it was a female jockey.
Yeah.
So that's what it was.
Yeah.
So there was always some kind of, you never got to just be there on your own merit sometimes. But it didn't stop her. She's a very determined character.
Yeah, Katie Walsh, she doesn't like the phrase female jockey,
yeah,
but and just prefers calling it her profession a jockey. But
yeah,
in the 70s, it was obviously just very unusual, almost unique in Ireland.
Yeah.
Your everyday life was you being the person that was different in any room that you were in.
I think, you know, there's a lovely book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, and it's all about this idea that there's no really such thing as a genius, because, or someone who managed to kind of brave the odds and do something on their own, because in many ways the people who come up through a certain situation are a product of all of the, like, little moments of luck in your environment. So for example, in my mother's environment, my grandmother was a matriarch. She I remember during the farmers' protest of 1966, but I always remember everyone talking about the fact that my granny led all the farmers marching on horseback up all the way to Dublin to protest about whatever the farmers were protesting about at the time. Mm. And so my mother grew up in an environment, a matriarchy, where there was 7 women and 1 son, my uncle. And in that sense, you weren't a girl, you were one of the group of people. And so you're not necessarily alienated. And my granddad definitely supported her career and everything that she wanted to do, and was very proud of her, and really put an emphasis on education as well as just the horse riding. And I think I had the same thing growing up. I grew up in an all-female family. I was the funniest person in my family. I was in an all-female primary school and secondary school. I was the funniest person in my school. I mean, that's to be debated by everyone else in the school, but I'm going to... They're not here now, are they?
I can only speak for myself. Have they gotten to my heights in the comedy game? Probably not.
Have they made the second captain's radio show? No. And so by the time I got to 18 and went to university, I had no idea that there weren't women in comedy. And even I remember watching the TV, it was Deirdre O'Kane or Tommy Tiernan. And so by the time people started telling me I was weird and it was odd, and people started going, "Or you're female, or you're a girl," I was like, am I? I just never realised. Up to that point, I'd managed to get away with being a person. And then all of a sudden, I started being kind of segregated. But as hard as it has been at a variety of times, because those little moments, those little niggles push away at you, at your mindset and your confidence sometimes, that inner...
The intrinsic thing,
which has been helped by my mother's determination, and also in on a very simple way, like my dad died when I was young. All the men who my mother knew were jockeys, and I had like 2 granddads. So I've never been intimidated by men, present company excluded, of course. You're both very intimidating. But for me, men were just like small, older, dead. So by the time I got into these environments where there are lots of men, I'm like, men aren't it? Are they? Oh, I just didn't realise I was supposed to be scared of you guys.
And it's an amazing role model to have. What you describe your mother doing there, it was mostly in Ireland, but I understand she would have gone off to the UK and Australia.
Australia in a big way, yeah. Actually, there's still a weigh room somewhere in Australia named Helen's Weigh Room. The weigh room, for those of you who don't know, is where they weigh the jockeys. Yeah, because she was the first person on that race course to ride against men.
Right.
Yeah, and there's still a weigh room now. At some point, I haven't toured in Australia yet, but I'd love to go down. If and when I go to Australia, I'd love to go and see it.
Was she still active as a jockey when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think I pretty much ruined that with my big head.
You put a stop to that.
Thank you. All focus on me now. Thanks, Mother. But I think like she would say that there's a certain point, which is what's kind of sad and maybe a relief in many sports people's careers, as opposed to, say, being an entertainer, is that there's a certain point you can't go on anymore, and you know you've reached your level. And I think my mother felt like, especially if she got married, she had kids and stuff like that, but she also knew, I think, it was time, because she'd reached a certain level. But she's never been out of the horse racing industry since, like, always growing up. There is myself, my sister Sinead, and then my little jockeys. I love my little jockeys. And she educates and looks after a lot of little jockeys, and they love her, and she loves each and every one of them. She's very cute.
Well, we interviewed Claire Balding in the last series. Murphy will remember that one. Mm-hmm. Claire Balding also has quite the background in horse racing.
Yeah, she's
She once had breakfast with the Queen. So I'm wondering who's the most famous person who came through your home.
Who came through my home? Oh, that's interesting. Do you know, this is clearly not the right answer you're looking for. But I remember one day, do you remember The Works with Mary Kingston?
Yes.
I think we all do. Obviously. Big shout out to all the fans of The Works.
Are you laughing? We all remember it well.
We all remember The Works, or Dream Television, as we called it as kids. Imagine getting to visit a tennis ball factory to see how tennis balls are made. Wow, oh wow. Oh, little gal can dream. I remember one time a kid wanted to be a jockey, and so they came down to race where my mother was working to do like a week in race, and Mammy, without telling us, brought Mary Kingston from RTE out to our actual house. And we'd been up on my neighbours, and we came down, and you know, in like BBC dramas where somebody tells someone a tragedy and they drop a cup to show that it's really funny, like your husband's dead. What? Not my bill. And they just like drop the cup.
Yeah.
We walked into the kitchen to find Mary Kingston, and I always remember like dropping a bar being going, no. And in my wildest dreams, I'd only ever imagine getting to speak to Mary Kingston. She's like, hi girls, I see you've loads of toys in your bedrooms. Do y'all like toys? I was like, yeah, man. Yeah, I do like toys, Mary Kingston. Yeah. And we couldn't. And she's like, what would you do if you were on The Works? And we were like, I can't even imagine ever being on The Works, Mary. And we just glammed up like the most boring children in Ireland.
Hang on, you're telling me this is not the answer I wanted. That's
a dream answer.
So yeah, that's my biggest celeb claim to fame.
Is it true that when you introduced your mum to the head of Channel 4 comedy, but I'll let you, a better presenter than I would allow you to tell the story rather than.
Well, I was doing the comedy gala, which is on at the O2, and which is for Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital. And it's like a big comedy gala, and it's not the best comedy night because you're doing 5 minute spots on quite a long bill to about, I think it's 16,000-17,000 people at the O2 in London. When you do something in an arena that big, it's not really made for talking, so the sound goes out and goes back. But this was my third time, and I was like, well, third time also unlucky, so why not bring my mother over? So I brought my mother over to kind of sit there and watch. And afterwards we were backstage, and I never really know what my mother's going to come out with, but the Channel 4 comedy person, who was kind of my boss at the time, came over and was like, well done, Aisling, you know, it'll all edit fine. I'm like, thanks.
Just said every performer wants
thanks,
to hear.
Mate. We'll add laughs afterwards. And and Mammy's like, why have you taken racing off Channel 4? And he was like, sorry, what? She's like, I'm a jockey, obviously. And I'd never mentioned my mother was a jockey, and I hadn't really introduced this woman as my mother either. So he just has this small Irish woman coming up going, why have you taken racing off Channel 4? And managed to kind of lay into him until the head of comedy agreed to kind of put horse racing back on.
I didn't realise your mum was the catalyst for all this. Amazing.
You know that sort of idea that when you're a small, you think all the teachers live in the school. Mm. It's that same idea that everyone in telly just will be able to fix it.
You are writing a show for Channel 4 about sisters at the moment.
Another
speciality subject.
Myself and Sharon Horgan have been writing together for longer than I've been doing stand up. So we've been writing together for about 8 years now. We've done that many scripts and they've never sort of gotten away. And this one is kind of close to my heart. It's my little baby, and Sharon and I are playing sisters in it, and we made the pilot just before Christmas, and then we got the news in early March that it's gone to series. So I'm writing it now, and it was just like, sometimes when you make your own work, and I'm sure it's the same with you guys who know when you kind of set up your own business and company and all that kind of stuff, God, it can seem like a slog, and sometimes you're like, God, would someone just give me a thing rather than having to work for it? Because with stand up you have to write all your own stuff and mine your own material, and sometimes it's, you know, it's quite a lonely business as well. But when you sort of feel like you've made it all yourself, even if it only goes to one series and then they cancel it, there's a sense of like, well, I did that, you know, we did that together and we kind of made that thing that we're quite proud of, which is always a nice kind of feeling, a sense of reward. So yeah, I'm quite proud of the show.
It's
called Happy AF, which stands for as so I can't say what the F is.
Well, it's one of a bunch of projects you're working on at the moment, some really impressive stuff. A lot of people will be familiar with you as a team captain on 8 out of 10 Cats, on various UK panel shows, that kind of thing. In the US, you're part of a new Netflix stand-up series, so things are going really well for you at the moment, Aisling. You've obviously had to graft to get these kind of rewards, but you're kind of living the dream now. Is that how it feels? Can you be satisfied with how it's going? Or are you always a little bit, as a lot of people are, anxious about what comes next?
I always am, and I'm not sure if that's a natural... I'm sure anyone's like this. If you grow up in a single-parent family, there's a lot of... always planning ahead and just down the line about life. And it is worth remembering to kind of be present sometimes, because, you know, I think being freelance as well, and actually while we talk about successes, I think it's also important to talk about all the failures. Mm. Like for every Netflix special, there's things that don't work. And as I say, first thing to get away in 8 years, I've, and maybe something like my 15th script, I've done like 10, I did like one year I did 10 or 11 pilots of TV shows that never went anywhere. They are the things that make you, but also they're so sad and disappointing, and most of it is grit and pulling yourself back up again. And not to say not to relish those moments where it all goes right, but I suppose no one posts photos of themselves on Instagram when you're eating spaghetti hoops out of a tin going, why? And actually the show we're making with Sharon now, the first draft of that, I wrote in 12 hours because I was so upset, because a show we'd been working on for 2 years with Channel 4 they were like, oh, sorry, after 2 years, it's not for us. Do you know what it was? I think Dairy Girls got commissioned around the same time, and our one was too kind of similar along those vibes. And now I love Dairy Girls. It's so amazing.
Yep.
But I was like, oh, no, something else. So I wrote like this in 12 hours. But now that's turned out to be the thing that's gone ahead. So, yeah.
You've mentioned a couple of times that you're from a single parent family, that your dad died when you were three, died by suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote an absolutely beautiful article about this in The Guardian last year. People might have read it in the Irish Times as well. What sort of a reaction have you had since putting all this out there?
Quite incredible, really. I suppose a big part of why I wrote it was, I remember the reason I sort of wrote the article was A, to put something in my own words, because once you're sort of in the public eye, people ask questions and stuff, and you know you're going to get flummoxed in an interview or something like that. But also, when I was growing up, there were just no stories anywhere, which sort of makes sense because like suicide was decriminalised in Ireland in only 1989, so 2 years after my dad died, and people still say committed suicide, and you can only commit a crime, so like the language around it is still pretty bogged down in a weird way. The reaction from it has been very overwhelming at times, because from having something that was your private family issue in many ways, and even within the family, private in certain circles, that we didn't sort of talk about it at all, to within literally an hour, as soon as it kind of hit the presses in the UK and Ireland, suddenly like people coming up to me in the pub knowing about something that was sort of my story, you feel a little bit like you've made a product out of your thing, which is, there are certain things I decide to talk about on stage and that I don't. And it was very odd to have that sort of feeling of like the amount, literally that weekend and since, I've probably had, I can't even count the thousands of messages I've read.
So this was this is the most personal thing in your world, and
suddenly
everybody knows about it. It must be kind of overwhelming.
Yeah, and I don't overwhelming for my family, and without a doubt, I don't regret it at all, because it's one of those subjects that we need to talk more about, because I don't think people know how to talk about it, because it's so bloody tragic. Mm-hmm. And it feels so, and you're like, can you make comedy out of it? Of course you can, because in all those moments you have to laugh. And I grew up in a house and a family with a huge amount of emphasis on humour and laughter, and my mother's great crack. And so all of our lives, humour was our coping mechanism. Sometimes, of course, a way we used to avoid talking about things, but a lot of the times our method of coping. And I wanted to sort of talk about it in a manner that's not so maudlin. And I felt like all the chat around it is always very maudlin, which means that people feel like they're going to ruin the atmosphere if they start talking about it. And, well, a couple of things I found from the thousands of messages I got in touch. First of all, I wanted to reply to everyone, but you couldn't. And you felt like every reply was going to be like, if you just wrote an XX, like it was going to be in some way unsatisfactory when someone has poured their heart out to you. And but the main thing I found was most of the people who got in touch with their stories were predominantly men. Men privately messaging me, who, a lot of dads, a lot of fathers who hadn't been able to talk about being able to cope. a vast majority of the amount of people who've been in touch about women who've taken their own lives, many of the people had known that their wives or girlfriends or daughters or sister had been ill for a long time. And predominantly a lot of the stories with the men were, we just had no idea. Mm. I mean, he did seem a bit down, but we had just no idea. And it really made me... I have this analogy at the moment. I really wish I spoke football, like the language of football. And I have this thing with my friend Bradley, who's like a kind of an English guy who does not talk about his feelings but loves football so much. And he is a fantasy football league. And I'm trying to teach him the language of emotion in exchange for like some football skills, because women aren't encouraged to talk about football growing up at all, or sports. We're always allowed just like have a load of periods, you know, 24 days a month to get out of PE, whatever it is. And we're never encouraged to... And then any woman who enters into football or sport tends to be treated like a unicorn. And then the same thing with men who are very emotionally articulate. Everyone's like, oh my God, he's so emotionally articulate. Can you believe it? Rather than there being any sort of socially acceptable way to teach boys and men from a young age to articulate their language. It's about having the emotional language to express yourself. And that has come across so overwhelmingly. If you have kids and young boys in school, if you're teaching young boys... The language, emotional language, that is the biggest thing we can do. It's so, I talked about this recently on Adam Buxton's podcast, so I hope you don't mind me crossing over
no,
on
absolutely.
It.
No, it was fascinating.
We listened, it was gorgeous,
But it's so overwhelming to exist sometimes, and it's so overwhelming to with all your problems and being a parent or not being a parent or getting out of a relationship or dealing with heartbreak and all the stuff that happens in any of our lives. That it's there's this such emphasis on being happy and getting happy and happiness, and like we should all look like we're living in a tampon ad, like we're about to kind of jump out a window or with kind of a bungee jump attached to a bungee thing attached to us and be running through, you know, fields of flowers. And that isn't actually anyone's existence. And that idea of having a super happy life is a really new idea, but it puts a lot of pressure on us to feel like we're not maintaining that or we're not fulfilling that. And actually it's about, I think, trying to live hopefully. And to try and hold on to hope that tomorrow might be better, and to little small habits or changes. If you're struggling and if you're trying to get through something or get through the day, what kind of tiny habit can you change or maybe make this week? Whether it's kind of mentioning that you're not feeling great to your wife or your partner. And I know, again, from a lot of messages I got through, that people are like, but I'm their rock. I am their person that they need me to be strong, to be a man, to be the caretaker. And if I admit that I'm not okay, that'll terrify her or that'll terrify my partner. Or if it's a mother, say, for example, postnatal depression, we don't talk about a lot. And people are like, oh no, if I admit that I'm not connecting with my baby, I'm supposed to be the mother. I'm supposed to be, and all these supposed to be's. Mm-hmm. But actually nobody cares as much as you do. And everyone would rather you say, I feel ugly, I feel weak, I feel lonely, I feel whatever it is. And then you can start to fix it. And then you can start to put slow little habits of change and moments of hopefulness, I think, are all we can kind of hang on to. Because the facilities, again, they're not there and they're not coming.
With all these people getting in touch with you and you handling all of that, has that part of it been tricky? You know, that you've got people coming to you with the heaviest possible load, and quite a lot of those people. Is it difficult for you to know what to say? You said obviously you don't just want to give a curt response, you want to talk about it. And it's great in a situation like this, a lot of people can hear what you say, but trying to get back to people affected by this in an individual an individual level.
Well, I suppose what I realise is most people want to be listened to, as probably shown by how little you guys have spoken during this interview. And I think what I had to sort of maybe come to terms with, it's that I have read every single message. So if you have sent in a message to me, thank you very much. And I've read it. I just haven't been able to reply. And I have read every single message and reply on Twitter, every WhatsApp message, every Instagram message, every Facebook message that you've sent. And a big part of maybe the point of me writing it was to start a conversation, to have a place. If you want to, this random person off the telly who you see on random panel shows, if you want to just throw a message with all of your feelings at me, I might not reply, but bloody do it. Send it, get it off your chest, send it to a stranger, write yourself a letter or an email of hopefulness and what you want to achieve or all the bad things and hope no one will write. Like, do it. And there's also something very therapeutic about writing. And why I was quite honoured to get a lot of these messages is when you write something, when you write a story, you can give it a beginning, middle and end. Whereas when you just constantly talk about stuff, like kind of now it comes out in scattered thoughts and bits from then and bits from the future and bits from the past. But when you write something down, you have to give your brain a chance to give it a shape and a structure. And I think there's something lovely about that. Put it down in some way. Just get it out and type it or write it down, even if you delete it afterwards. And I think that's been maybe therapeutic for people to do. And that's just have to be maybe enough for the moment.
What about for you, Aisling? You said in that Adam Buxton interview that you feel like a different person since the article came
completely
out.
Completely and utterly. Yeah, really? Totally. Just, I think it felt a little bit like we sort of had the funeral in a sense. It was an odd thing, that sort of release of something, which you didn't know you'd been holding on to for so long. And I think it's the same with a lot of people when they start opening up or talking about something. I think I always thought that the world was going to kind of collapse, and it didn't, and you'll be grand. And I think that's what I realised talking about it, because people are always like, oh, I was just afraid you'd get upset. I was just afraid I'd upset you, or I was just so afraid we'd upset your mother. I was so afraid we'd upset you. We didn't want to make anyone upset. And if you don't get upset, there's no way you can get over anything. To think you can kind of keep pushing through without ever getting upset is ridiculous. And it took me 30 years. But honestly, I just feel freer. I feel so free, and that there's never going to be a shock thing now that's going to come around the corner. Like, so you were talking about your father and how your father, like, it felt like it was going to creep up on me whenever I was doing like Jonathan Ross or something like that. Like, I'd get a curveball question or that it would come up. Whereas now, like, and I think it's the same talking about that subject matter. At worst, you're just going to upset someone, but it'll be out there. And it is, you know, hard to upset one or spring chat on someone, but then it's past and it's gone, and it is like little tumours being removed from your soul a little bit. So I would highly advise everyone to write an article for The Guardian if you get a chance, you know.
No, it really is. We appreciate you talking about it. I know it's not easy at all, and it does help to have somebody like you talking about this subject. You quoted in your piece a documentary, Grayson Perry, All
Yes,
Man,
yeah,
which I had a look at, and it's really interesting. He talks about this. Well, it's kind of a specific, the episode I watched was quite specific to the north of England. He goes up to Durham or somewhere like this, and he finds out how the men who worked down the mines and all the rest of it had to almost literally build up another skin. They had to build up a sort of an armour against the kind of hard life that they had to live. And that's been passed down through the generations, even though people don't really need that anymore, and it's actually not that healthy. And while that's specific to that area of England, maybe, I think men would probably understand that there's... It's now it's not expressed in the ways it was then. Now it's maybe expressed as bravado or as just trying to make everyone not worry people and have people think
and even
that
in
you're,
the language
you're strong
we use.
And confident. Yeah.
Yeah, even in the language we use. I mean, there's so many euphemisms for doing something badly. And one of them is being gay, and one of them is doing something like a woman. And that's really awful, because those words do creep into people's heads, and they suggest that an essence of someone. So to be me, and if you were to do something like a woman, like I would do, it would mean you were doing something to a lesser degree or to a worse state. But also to say those sort of things to men means there's a fear in any way of being thought of as emotionally vulnerable, or emotionally, the word we'd use as weak. I think with women, we definitely, it's of course, is a lot of pressure on women for so many reasons as well. But our responsibility, I suppose, to our brothers and our fathers and our sons, we also have to create a space where men can be our pals, and they don't have to be the towers of strength, and that we allow ourselves to, we are hardy and we can do it on our own and we're grand. So our men in our lives can be also the vulnerable ones, and to not kind of, you even see it in like passing comments about men on reality TV shows, a thing going, oh, he'd look after me, or he'd, as if that's the badge of success of a man, that he would have to be the caretaker. And that's a double-edged sword, because it keeps women in a certain box, but it also keeps men in a certain box as well. And I think we all have to look at our language and what we expect of men and of each other.
Okay, well, we'll tweet a link to your article if that's all right with
you guys. On Twitter? Wow.
Yeah, we're on Twitter. We're all the mod cons around here, Aisling, you know.
2015, actually.
No, it really is. It really is beautifully put together, and I think we couldn't recommend it enough. So we'll tweet out a link to it. We'll take a break now. After that, we're going to have a look at this sporting life of Aisling B.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
The wonderful Aisling Bee is our guest this morning on Second Captain Saturday. We're getting a huge response to this chat. A couple of the texts coming in. So proud to be from Kildare when I see Aisling's success. What an inspiration. Another one saying I could listen to that Kildare woman forever. Tommy Conlon, the Times journalist, has tweeted at Second Captains, lads, did I miss it? Or have you mentioned the name of Aisling's amazing former jockey mother? It's Helen O'Sullivan, Tommy. An absolutely amazing career, as you say. All right, Aisling, I think we've talked enough about your mum's achievements at this stage.
I'd say she'll disagree.
We only gave it like half an hour. How are your own horsemanship skills?
Horsemanship skills, not great. Yeah, I remember. I think the last time I was on a horse, I was about 15, and I went to go and ride out with my friend, and we went to the stables in Kildare, and I think, and really was just like hang out with a couple of the cool lads.
Oh yeah,
you know, they were cool lads, like they sort of like one of them smoked and they were just cool lads, and you're like, hi cool lads, and we'd all thought we'd kind of run around on horses together, and they must have heard maybe who Mammy was, so I think they gave me a sort of madder horse than I had the skills to cope with, because really I just sat at home all day watching like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and, you know,
well,
and the works.
We
yeah, exactly. And so I got up on this horse and we were riding through the fields and they all set off into a canter and I tried to keep up with them, but the horse just was like, not today, and sort of legged it off, and I was like on the horse going, please stop, hold on. And the horse threw me off. And I remember flying into the air going, and landing straight with my spine onto a big stone.
Oh,
ah. Yeah. And I had never had the wind knocked out of me before, but I was sure I'd broken my spine. And I looked up kind of blearily at all the lads and they were going, and I was like, and in my head, I thought to myself, like, goodbye, Mammy. Goodbye, Sinead. This cruel world hath ended me. And then I had to sort of make my way really hobbly back on the horse to the stables. And I was so afraid that I'd hurt something. And when we got back to the stables, it was a young lad who'd been mucking out the stables. And I was like, I fell on my spine. And I was like, I think I fell on a stone. And he was like, no, I think you fell in a pile of shite. And it turns out that I'd fallen on a big cow pat, but I thought it was a stone. But I'd fallen on it with such force that the that the pile of shite had permeated my clothes and gone all the way to my skin and through, like, right through the... Am I allowed to say shite? I'll give you the opportunity.
You've already
of,
said it twice. So.
Oh, yes. Yeah, of
this particular horse is already bolted.
Yeah. Poo-poo. And it'd gone right through my clothes.
Yeah, no, I actually have my own horse riding story because I haven't actually been on too many horses over the years.
You're legally too tall to go on a horse, are you?
See, this is the problem.
6'4" is the legal height.
I was in Cusco in Peru. Myself and my wife decided we'd go for a horse ride in the Andes. What a beautiful idea. So I rock up to this horse riding school,
right?
And this tiny Andean man walks out and he takes one look at me and it's obvious that I'm by miles the tallest, heaviest person that has ever rocked up to this horse riding school. So he kind of makes it clear straight off the bat that obviously my wife is more than welcome on this horse riding tour of the Andes, but that there's no way. They have no horse for me.
I can imagine you standing over the horse and its back not even reaching up to your crotch. You know, like standing over a red setter.
So after an extended delay, out comes this beautiful little pony that my wife gets on.
Yeah.
And then this absolute crock of a horse comes out. And honestly, I don't know that a horse can eye roll, but this horse eye rolled. So anyway, this ancient old fossil comes up and I throw me leg over. There was no fear of the horse running off on me anyway because he was 33 years old and I weighed more than he did. So it was very sedate.
What is your own sporting highlight? Surely you've had your sporting highlight already. That incredible durability that you showed in getting up after falling into the
managed to absolutely
shite off the horse.
That land.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure wherever that cow pat was, there's like a little blue plaque. So my greatest sporting achievement to date is actually a genuine one. And it's one of those things I'm purely proud of. Like, I'm really proud of myself. It was when I engaged in professional wrestling.
Oh.
Yes.
Sorry, I was a big wrestling fan growing up, so we're right in my wheelhouse.
I feel like
here.
I should leave the room.
In Nerd Zone, Tennessee.
Yeah.
What was the scenario? How did you...
So in Edinburgh, for the Comedy Festival, they do this thing called the wrestling, mm-hmm. and it's comedians paired with professional wrestlers. And we put on a 3-hour wrestling show, and it is so good. And it's not... I trained for 2 months for it. I properly trained in a ring with real wrestlers. And if you look at my Twitter handle, if you go on Twitter and look at my profile page, you'll see me lifted above the air by Marty Scurll, who in wrestling circles is a big deal.
Right.
And it was one of my... I planned it all so well because wrestling is all about the dramatics in theatre. Mm. And I was like, delighted by that part.
It's can do.
Yeah, it can do, thank you. Jazz hands ahoy hoy. And... it was also really like a dance routine. Like you learn, like the moves are brutal and you're thrown onto the mat and thrown around. But I've always loved doing stunt work and all that kind of stuff. And at drama school, we learned fighting and sword fighting and stunts and rolling over. And I love all of that. And we basically were like learning a dance routine, but with like these really some extremely overweight. One guy was called The Bulk. And when he got in the ring, we all had to go, whoa, and pretend to roll about. We had to learn these, essentially dance routines with these wrestlers because wrestling is a lot of pre-learned moves.
Sorry.
Owen, could you take off your headphones?
Well, what are we talking about here? Was this a tag team, Royal Rumble?
Survivor came down,
Series, cage match?
It was in Edinburgh. It was in a ring.
Yep.
And there were, I think, 4 or 5 professional wrestlers and then a kind of roll of comedians who some would get thrown out and some of them wouldn't. I made it until the very end. I came through about a third through and made it to the very end.
That is essentially a Royal Rumble. That's
a Royal.
Grown up on, yeah.
Oh, is that a Royal Rumble? Yeah. I came down. I was called Aisling Revenge for the Famine B.
Strong.
And I came down with 17 Irish flags sewn together like a cape.
Yeah.
And Catherine Ryan, the comedian, dressed up as a nun. And we had her little daughter Violet in a communion dress holding a potato and shaking it angrily at the audience. And I came down holding a candle.
Too subtle for the wrestling, maybe, though?
It was a really beautiful metaphor, actually.
Yeah, nice. Okay,
and I think people really did think about the famine more after that. And it came down to like Riverdance, you know, I am coming to nourish you, cherish you. And we came down with holding a candle. And then 1, 2, 3, 4. And then I climbed into the ring and like smashed this man over the head. He pulled me by the hair, swung me around. And it went on for ages. And then my final move was The Bulk, who was this big lad who came in, held me over his head in the air and twirled me round, and then he threw me into the air and out of the ring. And outside of it were 4 comedians who'd been trained to catch me, but it looked like I was like a log knocking them over. Oh, and so it was all really dangerous, like people broke their legs and stuff.
Yeah.
That's all part of the game.
Honestly, I was so proud of it. And I know some people other than Owen will debate whether it was a sporting moment or not.
I don't want to tell Murphy how to do his job here, but Kieran, if you don't... If Aisling doesn't blow David Baddiel out of the water, the fix is in.
Dave Baddiel do?
He went to Italy
literally
with Arlo Hamlin and a few other lads and scored a goal in a football match.
He scored a goal in his 40s. Yeah. I mean, I see men in their 40s doing 5-a-side probably every day in my life. That is not an achievement.
Murph, could you please rank this sporting life of Aisling B?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
You don't have stars in this game, Mr. Weaver.
What do you have, then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Right, Aisling, here goes.
Oh, God, literally never been this nervous. I'm so nervous.
Just breathe. Quick refresher on how we go about finding this year's greatest non-sports person, sports person. We will rank your sporting highlight and identify the sports person that we feel most closely resembles your sporting personality. And then brutally, fashion a score out of 100 from that information. So I have to say that your sporting highlight, your time as Aisling Revenge for the Famine B, is probably the best answer we've ever gotten to that question on this show. So, but it's also the patriotism that you showed as well as the skill. We saw that you had the words... Visit Ireland emblazoned on the arse of your costume.
Oh, I did, yeah. So it's to promote tourism in Ireland as well.
Of course,
yeah.
You know. It's a clear sign that Revenge for the Famine was proud of her roots. So your dedication to your cause is at the very heart of your success. You worked hard, you got your reward. So from that point of view, taking into account your relentless work ethic, I'd have to say that the athlete you most remind me of would have to be 3-time major golf champion Padraig Harrington. You probably get that all the time.
I do get that all the time. We both have very hammy, round faces and pull off polo t-shirts quite well. Wow.
He has Fulci Ireland on his gear as well. Not on the earth, but I mean, nevertheless, your endorsement was unofficial and written in pen as well. So it's been a triumph. You've earned 88 points 88. Out of 100.
What?
Now, on the other hand, there is the whole wrestling is a sport, isn't a sport. So I may have to deduct 10 points, giving you a final total of 78 points.
Wait now, whoa.
Ashling, revenge for the famine B, this has been your sporting life.
You look actually genuinely annoyed.
I want a steward's inquiry.
You should have 10 more points, in my opinion. A round of applause anyway, for a very grudging Ashling B.
For a very, very grudging.
It's about time he played a bit of the Cranberries and Second Captain Saturday. That's Linger, in case you needed any reminding. Ashling, revenge for the famine bee, is our new leader in the greatest non-sportsperson competition, thereby inflicting revenge for the famine on England's David Baddiel. Somebody needs to send Baddiel the message there.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're loving our chat with Ashling, listening to the conversation, welling up, really insightful and moving, says Darren Cope. Really great interview with Ashling this morning. Kind, insightful, engaging. Best episode ever, says another texter. As does Keane O'Donovan. Keane says, I've been a Second Captain's listener since 2004. Ashling, probably already my favourite interview. Great job all. So thanks very much for all of that. We do urge you to go along and see Ashling live at the Vodafone Comedy Festival in Dublin next weekend. We cannot guarantee that she'll be talking about her professional wrestling career, but we can guarantee that she'll be very, very funny. So she's on the Thursday and Friday nights. That's all in the Ivy Gardens in Dublin.
Give Ashling, the people what they want, Ashling.
Ashling spoke really powerfully there about her dad and about suicide in general. Just to say that if you are having your own struggles with your mental health, there are plenty of people you can talk to. Among them are the Samaritans. Their phone number is 116123, or you could go onto their website, www.samaritans.ie. I still haven't fully forgiven you, Murph, for docking points based on her Ashling taking part in the noble art, as it's called, of professional wrestling. Unbelievable stuff.
Okay, listen, I mean, if you want to take it all the way, you know, to like the court of arbitration for sport or something, don't worry. I'm prepared to defend my methods to the hilt.
Ken, we better get moving.
What's that?
Well, you've heard the klaxon, right? The klaxon's been sounded for all dubs to head to Omagh for the big match tonight. Owen Mulligan's been shooting his mouth off.
Right.
Really?
He's urged that Healy Park should become a hostile, intimidating and uncomfortable venue for the All-Ireland champions. We're not taking that from Muggsy, are we, Ken? You with me?
I assume it would be all those things.
Well, yeah. I mean, it might be quite hostile for Tyrone on the pitch. So that's my only concern. That's my one fleeting concern about how good a sporting occasion
atmosphere
this is going to be.
Atmosphere is one element.
Owen, I hope you enjoy it, though. You're on the road. It's going to be something new for you and your fellow Dubs fans, so go for it.
Thanks so much for all your messages. A load of great stuff coming in today based on our chat there with Ashling. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for everything, really. We're around all week with daily shows and Second Captain's World Service. Just go on to secondcaptains.com for that. We're back here next Saturday at 10 a.m. Mark Horgan and Simon Hick produce the show. Thanks to Sheila Newell on sound, Killian Down for researching. Marion Finucane is up next. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Ken.
We'll see you next week.
Captain, first captain, whatever.
They never go home, those boys.